He began to show up at the barracks with biology books instead of Field and Stream. The one most commonly observed under his arm or lying on the toilet tank in the crapper was Dr. John H. Maturin's 20 Elementary Dissections, Harvard University Press, 1968. When Buck Flanders and his wife went over to Kurt's for dinner one evening, Michelle Wilcox complained about her husband's gross new hobby. He had started getting specimens from a medical supply house, she said, and the area of the basement, which he had designated as his darkroom to be only the year before, now smelled of mortuary chemicals. Kurt started with mice and a guinea pig, then moved on to birds, eventually working his way up to a horned owl. Sometimes he brought specimens to work. "You haven't really lived," Matt Babicki told Orville Garrett and Steve Devo one day, "until you go downstairs for a fresh box of ballpoint pens and find a jar of formaldehyde with an owl eye in it sitting on top of the Xerox machine. Man, that wakes you up." Once the owl had been conquered, Curtis moved on to bats. He did 8 or 9 of those, each specimen from a different species. A couple he caught himself in his backyard. The rest he ordered from a biological supply house in the Berg. Sandy never forgot the day Curtis showed him a South American vampire bat pinned to a board. The thing was furry, brownish on the belly, and velvet black on the membranous wings. Its tiny pointed teeth were bared in a psychotic smile. Its guts were laid open in a teardrop shape by Kurt's increasingly skilled technique. Sandy believed Kurt's high school biology teacher, the one who had given him the C, would have been surprised at how fast his old student was learning. Of course, when desire drives, any fool can be a professor. It was while Kurt Wilcox was learning the fine art of dissection from Dr. Maturin that Jimmy and Rosalind took up residence in the Buey Gate. They were Tony's brainstorm. He had it one day at the Tri-Town Mall while his wife tried on clothes in country casuals. An improbable sign in the window of My Pet caught his eye. "Come on in and join our gerbil riot." Tony didn't join the gerbil riot just then. His wife would have had 1,000 questions. But he sent Big George Stankowski back the very next day with more cash from the contingency fund and orders to buy a pair of gerbils. Also a plastic habitat for them to live in. "Should I get them some food, too?" George asked. "No," Tony answered, "absolutely not. We're going to buy a couple of gerbils and then let them starve to death out in the shed." "Really? That seems sort of mean to—" Tony sighed. "Get them food, George, yes. By all means, get them food." The only specification Tony made concerning the habitat was that it fit comfortably on the Buick's front seat. George got a nice one, not top of the line, but almost. It was made of a yellow, see-through plastic and consisted of a long corridor with a boxy room at either end. One was the gerbil dining room, and the other was the gerbil version of Gold's Gym. The dining room had a food trough and a water bottle clipped to the side. The gym had an exercise wheel. "They live better than some people," Orvie Garrett said. Phil, who was watching Rosalind take a shit in the food trough, said, "Speak for yourself." Dickie Duck Elliott, perhaps not the swiftest horse ever to canter around life's great racetrack, wanted to know why we were keeping gerbils in the Buick. Wasn't that sort of dangerous? "Well, we'll see about that, won't we?" Tony asked in an oddly gentle voice. "We'll just see if it is or not."